Let's see if they like that. Okay, we're going to go on to case number 4, United States versus Haddad. Good morning, Ms. Wyckoff. Good morning.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Wyckoff. I'm a senior law student at the University of Chicago, practicing under a 7-Eleven license and representing Mr. Anwar Haddad. If the court permits, I will focus on the first two of the issues we argued in our briefs, beginning with the sufficiency of evidence argument and then moving on to entrapment. The government failed to prove one of the elements essential for a conviction under Title 18, Section 1957. It presented no evidence that could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that more than $10,000 worth of the funds drawn by each of the checks in question were derived from a specified criminal activity. The government itself does concede in its brief that Section 1957 contains some level of tracing requirement, since it accepts the approaches of the Fourth and Fifth Circuits. And even the most lenient approach, the Fourth Circuit, still requires the government to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that more than $10,000 in funds from a specified criminal activity have entered the account by the dates of the relevant checks.
The bank account where the funds went, where the two checks were drawn on a bank account, and 99% of the deposited funds came from the food stamp reimbursement program, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And when you look at the amount of income that was coming into the store at various points and tracking it, at the time those two checks came in, the bulk of that income coming into the store was illegal, wasn't it?
Your Honor, according to
the government's evidence.
It's impossible to say that beyond a reasonable doubt from the government's evidence. It would be possible for a jury to conclude, based on the financial evidence that the government presented, that some level of illegal activity was happening on this account by the time those checks were cashed. What it can't be said, beyond a reasonable doubt, is what level of illegal funds were entering the account. The government attempted to make its case under 1957 by presenting the jury with broad, generalized estimates about what was happening on the account over a 2.5-year period, which extended past the dates of the checks in question, and much of their evidence focused around August of 2002.
When you look at that exhibit that's attached to the government's brief, showing more than 350 questionable transactions on August the 1st. By questionable, I mean occurring in the middle of the night, moments apart, in suspiciously similar amounts that seem to bear no relation to actual purchases. Isn't that evidence that he's predisposed to engage in this conduct?
Well, I'm certainly happy to move briefly into the entrapment issue, Your Honor. The jury didn't need to take it that way, Your Honor, and it was the jury's province to decide how to weigh this evidence.
Can you address the circumstantial evidence? Because isn't this circumstantial evidence of the funds being those illegal funds?
Returning to how this circumstantial evidence bears on the sufficiency of evidence argument, Your Honor, that evidence cannot prove the government's case, first, because the government never attempted to articulate to the jury that, based on this record of redemptions, enough dirty money must have been in the account on the dates in question to satisfy the statute. And second, because when you look at this record of individual transactions, it cannot, by itself, prove beyond a reasonable doubt that any one transaction is fraudulent. It can raise suspicion about a great many of them, but it can't prove that any of them
were definitely.
Tell me
this, because I, for one, have not yet viewed the video. But in the video of the midnight shopping spree, will we see the store patrons exiting with bags of groceries, or did they exit empty-handed?
Your Honor, it appears from the trial transcript that many of the patrons left empty-handed. Mm-hmm. However, that evidence could have a number of explanations, and the jury was entitled to interpret it as it would. Furthermore, Your Honor, there's no evidence directly linking Mr. Haddad to performing any transactions that night. Therefore, there's no direct evidence of his involvement with any fraudulent activity that might have been occurring around midnight on that night.
He was present that night.
Yes, he was present at the scene. So were other employees of the store.
So your position is that there could be, number one, some innocent explanation for these transactions occurring every few seconds, really. I mean, when you look at some of these sequences, here's one sequence, just, at 12:21, three transactions.
This calls suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, and then, right, and then the amounts all being $49.99. I mean, just...
Certainly, Your Honor.
You know, when you look at what other possible explanation, I'm telling you, I'm having a real difficult time trying to figure out what legitimate transactions could be taking place.
Your Honor, it certainly is circumstantial evidence that food stamp fraud activity may have been occurring, but it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt that any one of these transactions was food stamp fraud. And since the government never attempted to articulate to the jury that based on this record, they would be able to calculate that enough dirty money must have been in the account by the dates of the checks in question, they can't meet their burden under Section 1957 just with this record of what happened on August 1st, leaving aside the fact that this is August 1st after the checks in question were cashed. I would also point out, Your Honor, that when you look at this record of multiple transactions for $49.99, it's impossible to know how much each of those transactions might represent of fraud and might represent of food purchases. It might be that a redemption...
Well, it's just hard to believe that they all end up with the net being $49.99.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. But what it's impossible to prove is how much of it is fraud.
But that uncertainty, it seems to me, is caused by the defendant's poor record-keeping. And ought we to be sitting here and rewarding such a strategy?
Your Honor, we don't want criminals to escape because of poor record-keeping, but we also don't want innocent people to be convicted because of it. It's the government's burden to prove every element of the statute under 1957, and they didn't even attempt to do that.
Well, the government gave a pretty conservative estimate based on the evidence was available. I mean, it's not a number that's, pulled from thin air. It's a sort of a best estimate for the extent of the fraud. And again, I say, we'd be rewarding people.
Your Honor, the government's burden was to show the jury what fraudulent activity may have been occurring on the account around the dates the two checks in question were cashed. It had to explain to them exactly what level of fraudulent funds were in the account and how much were actually drawn by the checks in question. They didn't even bother to articulate to the jury what the opening and closing balances on the account were during that day.
Well, isn't it sort of hard to believe that Congress meant to allow defendants to skirt the statute by commingling legitimate and illegitimate funds? I mean, the government is in a very difficult position of trying to show how much illegitimate how much legitimate inventory passed through the store when Mr. Haddad kept very few records. He claimed he was illiterate. So, what the government seems to have done here is it starts with Mr. Haddad's own statement of sales and uses as many invoices as it can find to determine how much actual inventory passed through the store. If nearly all the money in the account, as Judge Williams noted, was obtained through food stamp program, the fact that some legitimate funds were deposited, that shouldn't be determinative, should it?
Your Honor, what should be determinative is the specific language that Congress chose to adopt in Section 1957, which significantly differs from the language of Section 1956, where this Court did notice that there would be a problem with the statute being frustrated with by commingling and a tracing requirement. But under 1957, there is a specific requirement that this specific dollar amount be traced to specifically criminally derived funds. I see I've entered my rebuttal time. So
thank you.
Sit down.
Okay, Ms. Murphy.
Good morning. May it please the Court and opposing counsel. My name is Madeline Murphy. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney, and I will ask today that the Court uphold the jury verdict, the district court's decision not to permit the defendant to argue the defense of entrapment at trial, and as well the district court's determination of the amount of loss in this case. Judge, addressing first the sufficiency of evidence concerning the Section 1957 counts, it is clear from the record that there was no manifest miscarriage of justice. Frankly, it's overwhelming from the effort that the vast, vast majority of the money going into the R&F store accounts came from specified unlawful activity, the fact that it was tainted funds. First of all, the defendant confessed that he had been engaging in food stamp fraud for at least a year prior to August of 2002. He admitted that he had been engaging in this type of fraud specifically around the first of the month, which is when the recipient's link cards, benefit cards, are replenished by electronic transfer. He specifically stated that his estimate for the first day of the month was between $7,000 and $9,000 in illegitimate food stamp redemptions. Secondly, the videotaped evidence was overwhelming evidence that food stamp fraud was occurring. The Court may have the opportunity to view that, and it will see and can also learn from the testimony in the trial transcript that at midnight on August 1st, between 75 and 100 people attempted to jam their way into an 8-foot by 8-foot vestibule in the store, the R&F groceries little store. And testimony was that Mr. Haddad himself was sitting at the cash register at the time. Thirdly, Agent Berwick's financial analysis provides overwhelming evidence that the vast, vast majority of the money going into the R&F food store account came from illegitimate sources. His analysis showed that during this 30-month period of time, approximately $345 went into the account in cash. 99.96% of the money going into the R&F account came from reimbursements of food stamp redemptions. His financial analysis, working with the best records that he was able to get, showed that the vast, vast majority of those redemptions must have been fraudulent because they simply were not supported by any of the financial records. They were not supported by any evidence of any legitimate food sales.
You know, the closest issue here in this case, it seems to me, is the question of first impression, how to handle the accounting for the money laundering charges when the account contains both the legitimate and illegitimate funds. I mean, it's first impression for our circuit, I guess. You argue that 99.96% of the deposits in the account were EBT reimbursements, but elsewhere you concede that some part of those deposits were legitimate food sales. Can the government place a percent on what part of the funds deposited were legitimate versus illegitimate? Because my reading of the brief suggests that legitimate sales would be about 10% of the total. I mean, am I way off?
The total amount of redemptions, Judge, was about $1.1 million. Using the preponderance standard, as we did at sentencing, and giving the defendant all benefit of the doubt, at least 80% of those sales were illegitimate. Using the method of proof that we used at trial, Agent Berwick's analysis, approximately or a little in excess of 90% of the redemptions were considered to be illegitimate redemptions.
So what's the answer, 80 or 90%?
I believe the answer is 90%, Judge, based on the best available records that Agent Berwick had to work with. And I would ask that this court adopt the approach of the Fourth and Fifth Circuits concerning this commingling issue, since it appears closely analogous to the commingling solution that this court has arrived at for the companion statute, section 1956. The Rutledge case, the Ninth Circuit that the defense would prefer that the court apply, offers an all or none solution to this issue. Either all of the funds in the account must be illegitimate or all of the funds in the account must be withdrawn in order for money laundering involving commingled funds to be considered adequate or appropriate proof. Under these circumstances, it would not be hard at all for a sharp criminal or even a not-so-sharp criminal to realize that the trick to avoid a money laundering conviction would be to leave a little money in the account. I believe this was Congress's concern.
To what in the account?
To leave a little bit of money in the account, to not wipe out the entire account when withdrawing funds. So it seems that the approaches of the Fourth and the Fifth Circuits are more analogous to Congress's intent, more analogous to common sense, and more analogous to the solution that this court has applied in the context of a Section 1956 charge, where it appears that the commingling issue is the same. It is true that the elements of Section 1956 and 1957 do differ, specifically whether the amount of the transaction is at issue, and specifically whether the defendant knows that the money at issue is derived from the specific SUA. And thirdly, in 1956, the defendant must be shown to be using the funds for a particular purpose for promoting or disguising the activity, whereas in Section 1957, there is no such requirement of nefarious disposition of the funds. But still, the commingling issue is largely the same between the two statutes, so I would urge that the court apply the approach of the Fourth or the Fifth Circuit. Now, concerning the issue of the defendant's poor record-keeping, an argument, a strong argument can be made that the poor record-keeping in and of itself is circumstantial evidence that the defendant was engaged in criminal activity. So if someone is engaged in criminal activity, it's unlikely that they're going to keep meticulous records of that activity.
He seems to be illiterate or close to it. Does the record not?
Judge, there was no concrete proof of the defendant's level of literacy. And actually, of course, it would be difficult to prove if you're proving a negative. How do you prove that someone cannot read? But the jury must have found that the defendant either spoke sufficient English or understood enough written English to have understood that what he was doing was wrong, because the only source for them to make the determination on the knowingly aspect of the charge would have been the fact that the defendant was told in English or read in English during the application process that the exchange of food stamps for cash was against the program rules and could possibly lead to criminal prosecution. So he did have some level of literacy, and as the court will find itself in listening to the tape of the undercover transaction, he did speak some English. It's not the Queen's English, but he clearly understands what is said to him and is able to communicate, to get across his intentions. So the lack of records cannot be blamed entirely on poor English skills or on literacy issues. In fact, the tax returns were considered and discarded by Agent Berwick because it appeared that the figures stated on there did not reflect even what the government knew about the defendant's business income levels from the redemption figures. So it appears that there was even some effort to conceal the true income levels of the organization. So again, it can't be said that the defendant's literacy skills or language skills were the reason for the poor bookkeeping. On the issue of the amount of loss, again, the government used the best available records that it possibly could in arriving at the approximately $801,000 amount of loss. The government could have used the figure arrived by Agent Berwick during the course of the trial of approximately $900,000, and we chose not to use that figure in an effort to give the defendant every benefit of the doubt. It is true that we could not account for the possibility that some cash purchases of food may have been made. So we made the determination that we would go with the figure more favorable to the defendant using the annual food stamp figures that he placed on his own application as the basis for what his annual food stamp redemptions could have been or must have been. Though, again, it is true that this figure is not a precise figure, but still, the figure was apparently derived from the 1998 sales of the store by its previous owner. And as a matter of logic and common sense, how much could that figure have changed during the course of a period of only 4 years? As the Alboray case states, the defendant had an opportunity to change those figures during the application process. He certainly had every opportunity to amend those figures during the period of time between the application and the time that he actually ended up being convicted in the Alboray case, and he chose not to. So under the circumstances, the government's decision to use the best available figures based on the defendant's own statement was a sound one and has been upheld by this court in the past. I can see that my light is on. So again, I will ask the court to affirm the verdict and uphold the district court's decision not to permit the issue of entrapment to be argued to the jury, and also to affirm the amount of loss as calculated by the district court.
Thank
and
you.
Unless the court has any further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, moving on to Mr. Haddad's entrapment argument. This court has consistently held that a defendant need only present some evidence that could conceivably persuade a jury that entrapment occurred, and then he has made a prima facie case and is entitled to a jury instruction. Indeed, in almost every case this court has articulated, an entrapment should be given to the jury because juries have the sole privilege of making determinations about intent and credibility, and these are intrinsically tied up with the question of whether entrapment occurred. Now, Mr. Haddad presented more than sufficient evidence under this court's precedent to meet both of the prongs of the entrapment test. Turning our attention to the audio recording of his transaction with the female informant, a reasonable jury that listened to this audio recording of the transaction with the female informant would naturally have inferred that she was inducing him to perform this transaction by offering him, to put it bluntly, sexual favors.
Do I understand, however, he admitted he had been involved in these transactions from months before the event?
I have two responses to that, Your Honor.
Try one.
Your Honor, he gave a jailhouse statement, and the credibility of that statement was hotly contested before the jury.
There is evidence that he said he was in the business beforehand.
The government presented rebuttal evidence on predisposition. However, when determining whether an entrapment goes to the jury, this court looks only at the defense. And what Mr. Haddad's evidence showed on this tape, from the total context, we can tell that the government's informant came behind the security barrier and stood close beside Mr. Haddad while this transaction was going on. I want to emphasize to this court the significance of this contextual positioning. I want to make sure you can visualize the layout of the store. there's a small entryway to which customers are typically restricted, and the cashiers and the stock are protected behind a security barrier. And then there's a locked gate and a window through which customers usually get their pay for their purchases. Now, if this was a typical instance of food stamp trafficking, this transaction could have been conducted at arm's length over the counter through that window, but it wasn't. This informant was invited inside behind the security barrier, where we can tell from the context she must have been standing.
So you think there may be two transactions involved instead of one?
No, Your Honor. I think that the natural inference that a jury would draw from the total flow of this conversation is that there was one transaction, one deal made, and the deal was sexual favors in return for him changing his mind about his initial refusal to perform the transaction and agreeing to cash her food stamps. If you listen to the tape, you'll see that there's long moments of silence during the transaction while she's standing close beside him, but there's still clearly some kind of nonverbal interaction going on between them. Then there comes a point where this interaction stops or something happens.
The pauses are pregnant with possibility, you mean?
Precisely, Your Honor. A jury would have heard those pregnant pauses and would have drawn natural inference from them.
I can't wait to listen to them.
I urge you to do so, Your Honor. And I urge you to pay particular attention to the point in the conversation where Mr. Haddad abruptly asks, in perhaps a disgruntled tone of voice, "What's wrong?" And she responds with a soothing tone of voice, "Nothing." She says she's feeling a little sick, that's all, and also her child's outside. And then she apologizes to him. And then she says, "Don't worry, I will come back and visit you later after you get off work." They make a plan to rendezvous at 3 a.m. Your Honor, a jury hearing the tone and the flow of this conversation would naturally infer that what she was doing here was reassuring him that she would come back and finish, if you will, consummate the bargain that they made.
This good way is, of putting it.
Sorry?
That's a good way of putting it.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is more than sufficient evidence under this court's precedence to show inducement, and Mr. Haddad also presented sufficient evidence on his own lack of predisposition. He totally refused to trade food stamps with the government's male informant, and he initially refused the woman as well. So this alone makes out a more concrete case for lack of predisposition than we saw in cases such as Stalker and Lockley. And therefore, Your Honor, given these more than sufficient, given that Mr. Haddad fully met his burden under both inducement and lack of predisposition, he presented a substantial question of fact as to whether entrapment had occurred. And under this court's clear precedence, that question should have been decided from the jury and was wrongly kept from it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wyckoff. You were appointed, and you have our profound thanks for the fine job you did for your client.
Hear, hear.
And our thanks, as always, of course, to Judge Mikva. And our thanks to Miss Murphy, too, for the fine job she did. Okay.